next case.
You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Tyler Shands for the appellant, Annie Llewellyn. We're appealing a order of the Henrico Circuit Court for failure to honor a credit pursuant to Virginia Code Section 8.135.1 of a payment made by Erie Insurance, a UIM insurer, for a payment of $750,000 under the policy as a person liable for the same injury. The effect of that refusal to allow the credit changes the verdict from $1.5 million to $2,250,000. My client's insurance policy was only $250,000, so the original verdict of $1.5 million already exceeded her coverage by $500,000. She is now, if the credit is not granted, $1,250,000 in the hole.
Suppose there were no subrogation. Suppose there was no agreement to waive subrogation. Suppose subrogation was available, contractually agreed to, and could theoretically be enforced. How would that affect the equation, if at all?
I don't think it necessarily affects the equation. It certainly makes it more equitable to grant the defendant the credit here, because it would be readily apparent that the defendant was going to pay $750 twice. But I don't think it changes the fundamental framework.
Excuse me? You say that would be a reason to grant the tortfeasor a credit?
I believe it would, a credit towards the plaintiff and the verdict, not to eliminate the subrogation by Erie. Erie has that right.
But wouldn't the judgment be the same? They wouldn't get a credit on the judgment.
Oh, I believe if Erie had paid post-judgment, there would be $750,000 credited towards that judgment. The judgment would have been a $750,000 verdict, and if Erie had retained their subrogation.
Do you have any authority for that? I certainly understand, because Erie would be substituted for the plaintiff as far as recovering the $750,000 of the judgment. But why would that reduce what the judgment is?
It would reduce what the judgment is under 8.135.1, because it's a payment for the same injury. It would be that credit.
Well, 35.1 doesn't apply to judgments. It applies when there's a settlement.
It applies to a settlement. It could apply to a settlement post-judgment if there was a settlement.
But if there was not a settlement?
If there was not a settlement, then the judgment would be there.
Exactly what it is now?
It would not be what it is now. It would be what it is now, but the $750 would be paid to Erie and not paid.
Right. Your client would have to pay it and just be paying it to a different person.
You'd pay it to a different entity, yes.
But so what if we... Again, forgive me for interrupting, but if we put these into conceptual boxes, the full satisfaction rule always protects your client when subrogation has not been waived. No one's ever going to make you pay more than the jury verdict, no matter what. There's no theory of law that would prevent that, right? So you don't need protection there. And the question then becomes, all right, if there is either no subrogation or subrogation's been waived, what's the harm?
Well, the harm is on multiple levels. One is the defendant is going to be paying $750,000 beyond the actual verdict. So we're not honoring the verdict amount.
Excuse me. How are they paying $750,000 beyond the actual verdict amount when the actual verdict amount is $1,500,000?
The $1,500,000 is the verdict amount, but the plaintiff has already been paid $750,000 of that number. The plaintiff is going to be ahead an additional $750,000.
What does that have to do with your client? Them being ahead is different from what your client owes because of their negligence.
Well, my client is going to have to pay an additional $750,000 in this case.
Only because they have a judgment against them for $1.5 million.
Right.
They're just going to have to pay their judgment, is what you're saying.
Well, but they should be credited the $750,000. The plaintiff has received the benefit of her bargain. She received $750,000 from Erie, which is exactly what Erie's contract required.
I guess the thing that I don't understand is the benefit of her bargain with Erie, but that doesn't have anything to do with the benefit of her damages from your client for what they did.
What it has to do with, Judge, is UM is a hybrid. UM is contractual, but it's also a tort. The statute creates a subrogation right which gives the UIM carrier leverage as to the plaintiff and leverage as to the defendant. The leverage that the plaintiff or that the UM carrier has towards the defendant is, if we don't waive subrogation, we hold that hammer over you to make you get experts, to make you develop witnesses, to potentially even try the case we want you to try it the way we want you to try it. In this particular case, they entered into a release, and that release document releases any claim, and it releases the entire claim based on the lawsuit.
But it doesn't release the claim against you. They waived their right to subrogation. They did not waive their right to recover from your client. Those are two different things.
They are two different things, but the statute creates the subrogation right for that $750 in the hands of Erie. Erie gave that right away, presumably because the defendant was adequately defending the case.
But the question is, who did they give it to?
I believe they gave it back to us, Judge.
Well, then why didn't you sign the agreement? I didn't see your name on the agreement.
I was not on the agreement, Judge, but it certainly affected the course of the case, and it certainly affected the way the case was handled.
But it seems as though the thrust of your argument is that the UM-UIM statute creates basically a proxy defendant through the way the insurance works, and that proxy defendant should be treated like any settling defendant. But there are, by my count, seven other appellate courts in other states on exactly this point, UM-UIM collateral source issue, that say that's a reasonable argument, but it doesn't close the loop. And it doesn't close the loop in large part because unless there's subrogation, there's really no loss to the defendant, and the statute's not really clear that the collateral source rule generally should be statutorily repealed in this instance. So how do you deal with that weight of authority? You have a couple of cases, Wisconsin, well, it looks like it's just Wisconsin. No, Wisconsin and
Connecticut.
So you want us to swim against the tide. Persuade us as best you can that we should do that.
Well, the first distinction and the primary distinction is in Virginia we have 8.01, 35.1. None of those cases have a credit statute like this. When the legislature enacted that statute...
Let me stop you there. None of those cases mention a credit statute such as this. We don't know whether those states have them or not.
Well, I've got to assume that counsel was doing an adequate job in briefing the cases in those states to have brought it up, because it certainly would apply if it was the same statute we have.
But you know, the common law has a joint tortfeasor principle exactly like this. The statute really didn't change anything, it just codified it.
Well, it did, because it eliminated the tortfeasor language and the liability in tort in 2007.
But the release of one, release of the other was changed by statute, but what wasn't changed but actually codified was joint tortfeasor's contribution towards an ultimate judgment would be a pro tanto credit if you're in a pro tanto state, or pro rata credit if you're in a pro rata state, to the surviving tortfeasor, right? So the credit issue, whether it's pro tanto or pro rata, that's, I think, correct me if I'm mistaken, that's been around for, well, it's been part of the common law since the beginning.
It has, Judge, but what changed in 2007 is we eliminated in Virginia the word tortfeasor and liable in tort. We made it broader, and we made it broad enough, and the General Assembly knew that the UM statute is there. They are aware of UM subrogation. They're aware of all these obligations. The presumption is when the legislature changed that amended that statute and broadened 8.01, 35.1, they were opening up the credit for UM. UM is different because of this subrogation chip and because of the buy-in that the UM participates throughout the course of the case. and then can choose to step out of the case if they want to pay their money in advance. And what they did is paid their money in advance. If we eliminate this...
But they could choose to step out of the case from the beginning. They don't have to participate at all.
Absolutely, Judge. But what this will do is, if we don't give a credit for the UM payments, is we're going to damage the ability to settle. One of the reasons the legislature put in 8.01, 35.1 was to facilitate settlement. If we eliminate that provision and we eliminate the credit due to a UIM payment, we're going to have a situation where these cases don't get resolved and the defense is going to be responsible for additional monies.
It seems like to me a simple answer to that would be what the UM carrier does with their subrogation rights. If the UM carrier entered an agreement with the defendant not to pursue subrogation, then the defendant would have every incentive to do exactly what they do now. But that's not the situation we have here. They didn't enter an agreement with the defendant not to pursue subrogation. They waived their subrogation rights in general.
Justice Goodwin, it's not in the record, but there are always discussions regarding subrogation between the UM and the defense attorney. There is a constant dialogue, and I think the court can recognize this in the normal course of the defense of a case. If I'm the UM carrier or if I'm the underlying defense attorney, I am always in touch with the other to make sure that there is a concert of the defense and the defendant is operating and doing what the UIM carrier wants the UIM carrier to do in the case to get that subrogation waiver. I see I've only got 3 minutes and 40
seconds. Right. And I'm just saying that the defendant did not get a subrogation anything. They didn't get anything because they're not part of the agreement.
Well, they're not part of the agreement, but there's a subrogation waiver which inures to the defendant's benefit because the defendant has been operating under the guidance of the UIM carrier through the course of the case, just like every defense attorney who is doing the right thing does, because they know the hammer of subrogation is over the defendant's head. I've got 3 minutes and 18 seconds for rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Robert Lofton from McGuire Woods on behalf of the appellee and Michelle White. The short answer to the assignment of error that's before the court is the UIM policy from Erie that was purchased by my client and the premiums were paid for by my client is a collateral source and is not subject to the offset under Code Section 8.01, 35.1.
How does it work, Mr. Lofton, when subrogation is not waived? What prevents, what doctrine of law makes it sensible? Because it wouldn't be sensible to pay the 1.5 and on top of that have to pay 750. That just doesn't make sense, right? So what doctrine of law protects them against that scenario, which I concede is not your case, but we'll have to figure that out.
Well, I think, to answer your question perhaps in a slightly different way, Justice Kelsey, I would say subrogation is irrelevant. As this court just recognized in Alstom Restatement 2nd, Section 920A, makes the point, to my knowledge, it's the first time this court has cited 920A in an opinion. And if you read the commentary in 920A, it makes the point, which I think applies here, that subrogation is ultimately irrelevant to the collateral source.
Because of the full satisfaction rule?
Well, because of the full satisfaction rule, and because, as this court has recognized, going back to 1877, when it first recognized the collateral source rule, that if there is going to be a windfall, it should be in favor of the tort victim.
Right. I'm thinking the inverse, which is the defendant's point of view. So am I right, and don't let me put words in your mouth, you would accept the proposition that in the event, in this scenario, your case, subrogation was not waived and the carrier intended to pursue subrogation, the defendant would still be protected against paying a dollar more than 1.5 to anybody total?
Right? Yes.
Okay. So, all right.
The judgment amount, and to follow up on your questions and Justice Goodwin's questions, the judgment amount against Ms. Llewellyn is $1.5 million. That's what she has to satisfy. She had insurance of $250,000, and as the court is aware, there's a fraudulent conveyance suit that's ongoing right now in Henrico County, because with the first trial that happened in this case, after the jury was seated, after opening arguments, Ms. Llewellyn announced that she had declared bankruptcy, and in that she indicated that she had assets between $1 million and $10 million. in between the first trial and the second trial, a lot of those assets were, we think, were fraudulently transferred.
So, and so going back to the scenario, so if subrogation weren't waived, mm-hmm. and the carrier is just sitting around playing, you know, playing cards with the defense attorney and not showing their cards, and the defense attorney gets hit with 1.5 and he tells his client, there's no appeal there, just pay the 1.5.
Right.
There's no threat at all under the full satisfaction rule of the carrier coming back, the UMUIM carrier coming back saying, no, you now owe me 750, because the carrier's rights are derivative of the plaintiff and the plaintiff got full satisfaction. Is there anything in that logic that you disagree with?
Well, I think not necessarily, no, Justice Kelsey. I mean, I think that the point is Ms. Llewellyn is required to satisfy $1.5 million.
And not a dollar more.
Correct.
And so the subrogee of the subrogor can't get that dollar more.
Possibly not.
What's your authority for that, though?
Say again?
What is your authority for that?
Well, that's not a subtle question. And that's why I think the comment in Restatement 920A is really helpful. I don't think so.
That's actually what I'm asking. It depends on subrogation. Because you've got the, you know, windfall for the plaintiff, not a windfall, they purchased it on their own. And you got the defendant saying, well, wait a minute, you can't create liability beyond the liability that's been determined. That's what the full satisfaction rule does. But if your theory on the credit issue permits that, that stresses out the equilibrium between the two ideas.
Well, I think, as this court just said in Alstom, the collateral source rule is a narrow exception. And it should be applied in favor of the tort victim. And that's why I think, for purposes of this case, but also for the rule that should be articulated from this case, I think subrogation ultimately is irrelevant and it's immaterial. And the point is a tortfeasor should be responsible for satisfying a judgment. And the collateral source rule has always made clear that a tort victim who has insurance, regardless of whether there's subrogation or not, is allowed to recover that insurance, and the tortfeasor does not get any benefit from that.
Yeah, generally speaking, but you know, his point is not unfair. His point is that the way UMUIM works is the carrier is operating as a shadow defendant, the same defendant, defending the very defendant.
This court in 1962 in Horn with UM coverage said a tort victim is allowed to have double recovery. So, I mean, it has been the law in the Commonwealth since Horn.
But not more than full satisfaction of the total number, 1.5.
This court has not said that. And so, and as recently as Alstom, less than 2 months ago, the court recognized that a windfall may happen. And if it does happen, it should be to the benefit of the tort victim.
Yeah, but even when there is a windfall, it is never going to prejudice the defendant. The
Correct.
Defendant is never going to be required to pay more than a judgment that was imposed against them.
Correct.
By a court of law.
I
think that was the worry that Justice Kelsey had. And I think, really, there's a distinction between the collateral source rule and subrogation. They're two different concepts. They're related, but they're really independent. Because
yes.
And it almost seems like, to me, the answer to your question has to do with the definition of what subrogation means. Subrogation, of course, and we all know, it means that the insurance company is substituted for the plaintiff up to whatever amount it pays. And that's true whenever someone tries to recover on that judgment. So the defendant is never going to have to pay more than what the judgment is, and any amount of the judgment, which is covered by the insurance, just goes to the insurance company as opposed to the plaintiff.
Yes,
that's the way it works.
Yes.
Okay.
But I don't think the court, I mean, you obviously can address subrogation, but I mean here I think the narrow issue is UIM a collateral source?
And I think does 8.0135.1 factor into this at all in your analysis?
No, Justice Powell. It
Tell
does not.
Me why not.
I think the law of this Commonwealth since 1877 has been very clear that insurance like UIM that is purchased and obtained by a tort victim is not allowed to be used to offset any judgment that is entered against a tortfeasor.
Does 8.0 35.1 call into question that loan history?
Not at all.
What does it mean in this context? You're saying it has no applicability.
I do not think it has any applicability at all, Justice Powell. I think if you look at this court's decisions in GEICO, the court made clear that UIM is the duty owed by a UIM carrier is to its insured to pay the insured the damages that he or she is legally entitled to recover. So the UIM is insurance, just like health insurance, life insurance, homeowners insurance, that operates outside of the offset rule that's in 35.1, because 35.1 is structured to in a situation where you have joint tortfeasors. Or with the amendments.
Is it because the General Assembly took the language of tortfeasors out?
It did, and as this court recognized in Smith in 2015 and in Gordon in 2017, the purpose of those amendments was to ensure that 35.1 applied not just to tort cases, but to tangible and intangible property cases. This court has never said, and there's no indication from the General Assembly, that the 2007 amendments in any way altered, abrogated, impacted the collateral source rule. And there's no corresponding amendments in 38.
That's because the statute is codifying a principle of common law, which is joint tort feasors have to get pro rata and pro tanto credits.
Correct.
When they pay on a settlement. And the weird thing, as Justice Powell's pointing out about UIM, is it takes the ordinary insurance issue and it makes it into a de facto defendant. You say they have the duty to pay, yeah, but they're trying not to pay, and they're spending a lot of money trying not to pay.
Correct.
So it's a peculiar case. It's not resolved by the law back to 1850. It's just a peculiar case.
Well, Justice Kelsey, it is a peculiar case, but this court in GEICO said that a UIM carrier is not a party. The purpose of being served technically as a defendant is to put them on notice.
So they sure seem like a party when they're hiring experts to oppose you, they're arguing against you, and have a lawyer there saying you should lose.
Yes, but their duty is to their insured. Their duty is not to the defendant. Their contractual relationship is with the insured.
That's the peculiar part.
Yes. And that's why I think, it is peculiar, but I think UIM naturally fits within the rubric of the collateral source rule. Section 920A recognized that it is insurance just like any other type of insurance.
Am I correct? Your argument tracks pretty much down the line the North Carolina Supreme Court most recent opinion?
Yes, Justice McCullough. The Hairston case outlined very clearly why UIM should be treated as a collateral source.
It seemed to match up pretty well.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay.
So here I think it's very clear that the lower court was correct in its judgment below. And we would ask this court, unless there are any other questions, to hold that UIM, such as the policy that was purchased here by Ms. White, is a collateral source and therefore is not subject to offset under 35.1. Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Just briefly. The release in question in this case is included in the final order on page 66 and 67 of the appendix. It released Erie in whole and in part for specifically all of the matters in this case, but it went further than that. It agreed that all the liens would be satisfied by Ms. White, and it also dismissed Erie. If we're to believe that Erie was not a party, why would they need a dismissal? They would have needed to be released or quashed as to service, but they dismissed them. Their intent was to alleviate Erie and to get Erie out of the case. If we look at whether this is payment for the same injury under the statute, 8.01, 35.1, it is liable. Erie is liable for payment for the same injury.
Let me ask you
that
this.
Is the language of the statute. Yes, Justice Goodman.
If Erie stayed in the case as UIM carrier, do you think a judgment could have been entered against Erie?
I think a judgment would have been entered, and by contract, Erie then would have been required to pay $750, which would have been credited towards the judgment.
Who would the judgment be against?
The judgment would certainly be against Annie Llewellyn, Justice.
Which is what happened?
Which is what happened, but the payment was not credited, which is required by 8.01, 35.1.
What makes you think that 35.1 applies after a judgment is rendered?
It applies to any payment for the same injury. The language eliminated tortfeasor. It eliminated liability and tort. It says liable for the same injury. And it is as just as you had in the Gordon case, Justice Goodwin, where you were looking
by. Do you have 35.1 handy in front of you?
I do, Justice.
Read the first sentence of that.
When a release or covenant not to
Stop
sue.
Right there. When a release or covenant not to sue is given, that's when this statute applies. So how does it apply after judgment is entered?
Well, I don't believe it changes it. It is still a payment for the same injury. If you have liability for the same injury, the defendant still gets credit. This is the idea is the full satisfaction rule. The idea is the common law that the defendant can't be required to pay more than the amount. Without that credit, the defendant in this case is going to be required to pay $2.25.
Tell me, under what circumstance do you think the defendant is going to have to pay more than $1.5 million?
Well, right now, the judge has not credited the...
Okay, so how is your client going to be paying more than the judgment?
Because my client should be given the credit.
No, we're not talking about what the insurance company has paid. We're talking about money coming out of your client's pocket of more than $1.5 million. Tell me how that scenario happens.
The scenario again happens if the credit is not given, Justice Goodwin. I think it's semantics.
I don't think you're hearing Justice Goodwin. You'll never pay more than 1.5, no matter what we do today or what we don't do today. You'll never pay more than 1.5. Is that a correct or incorrect assumption?
That is a correct assumption, and that's why we've asked for the credit, right, Justice Kelsey, for the $750,000.
You have just a few seconds left. If we look at these statutes, and by our best lights, we don't see a clear answer. It's just not clear. You may be right, he may be right as to what's intended. What's the default principle? Should we defer and wait for the legislature to address the question, or should we strike out on our own and come up with a novel answer of our own and see if that sticks?
I don't believe you have to strike out on your own like the North Carolina court did. We have the statute. We have an amendment which was made when the UM statute was in existence, where they eliminated the tortfeasor rule, where they eliminated the word tort and granted the credit. I think the statutory directive is there, and the credit should be applied based on that. Thank you for your patience with me.
Call the next case.